Before we get started with today's episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight, we want to let you know that we have exclusive bonus content on Patreon at patreon.com/ampedup. You can find the video versions of all our interviews, as well as bonus content with me, Ryan's producer, Rob Bermudez. So make sure you check out our bonus content today at patreon.com/ampedup. Thanks for your support and enjoy the show.
Welcome to Amped Up. This is your host, Ryan Knight, and our guest today is Comrade Gomer. Gomer is an activist and better known as the communist educator for the common man. Gomer, welcome to Amped Up.
Thank you so much, Ryan. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. Before we get into the good stuff, I want to first, you know, just start off and ask you about Joe Biden and the Democrats' rescue plan. Rescue, in quotes, plan that Biden is signing into law today. The Democrats promised $2,000 checks and a $15 minimum wage, which for many of us were already like the compromise of the compromise positions. And of course, they didn't deliver on that. The Democrats are delivering $1,400 checks and no $15 minimum wage. Yet, the American Rescue Plan is being sold to the public as if it is the New Deal, when in reality, it is less than the bare minimum and more broken promises from Democrats. Now, while it does provide some much-needed small relief for people in the short term, it provides no structural reforms to our decrepit capitalist system. Gomer, what is your reaction to Biden's rescue plan?
I love that you're asking me this, Ryan. I was all ready to talk theory right away, but yeah, if you want me to talk shit on Joe Biden, I can do that for sure. So the funniest thing about this is them getting the news media to tout this as like slashing poverty in half or whatever, right? I mean, if you can imagine that $1,400 is going to slash poverty in half, it's hilarious. I don't even know what that means. Like, half is such a funny number to pick, you know. But
maybe cut it in half for like 2 months.
Cut your immediate poverty in half until you go right back to it. So I mean, the funniest thing about it to me is that we're in a place where if you look at what Marx talked about with things getting worse and worse constantly, with the way that the companies have to squeeze us harder and harder every year. They only have technological advances every so often. So to meet those quarterly marks, they have to keep squeezing us, right? And people don't like that, right? You and I, especially, you know, living where we live, rent is high, the cost of living is high, and every time we get squeezed a little bit harder by our boss, whenever the rent goes up and our pay doesn't, we're in big trouble. But then whenever something like this happens, like a pandemic where tons and tons of people lose their jobs, start losing their houses, it starts to feel very revolutionary, right? Like people are getting to a point where they cannot take it anymore, right?
Yep.
So the thing that the government is supposed to do in those the thing that a capitalist government is supposed to do to keep capitalism going, mind you, I'm not saying what they should do as a moral obligation. I'm saying what is simply necessary to keep capitalism going is to step in and say, okay, companies, y'all can't squeeze people this hard. We're going to pass the tax relief. We're going to restructure things so that y'all pay people so that they can get enough to get by, right? We're going to make a bunch of government programs so that out of work people can get jobs. Like talking about all the New Deal type stuff, right? That was literally to save capitalism. And FDR said himself it was to save capitalism, right? So what's really funny to me about this is the government is so controlled by these companies that they can't even do what it takes to save capitalism in the long term, right? The companies are so driven by quarterly profits at this point that they've completely neglected the long-term view. The idea of replenishing the work supply by having children is so foreign to people like the Generation Z coming up now, Zoomers. They aren't even thinking about having kids at all, right?
Nope.
The idea of
they can't afford to.
Exactly. They simply can't afford to. But in the past, that was always seen as a necessity to have enough money to have kids so that the next generation of workers could come about, right?
And be exploited.
To be exploited, absolutely. To be squeezed as hard as we are, without a doubt. But Also significant is this idea of like people getting squeezed so hard that they can't even afford their basic rent, their basic like car payments, the necessities that they have to get to work. Because Marx always said, you have to pay people enough to get them to live, to get them to get to work, and to get them to have kids so that they can have a new supply. That's not anything good. That's not anything moral. That's simply the baseline to keep capitalism going. So this whole idea of like these trickling out little checks that are supposed to save the world is hilarious, because it is not even doing the barest of bare minimum to keep capitalism going. We're literally in revolutionary times, and people and the government is not doing enough to stop the revolution. It is unbelievable to me.
Yeah. You know, but if just kind of in a broader context, though, I mean, this is progressives in the United States have been trying to fight for social democracy and reform capitalism for a century now. Yet,
yes,
our decrepit capitalist system is more rigged than ever against the poor and the working class.
Yes.
Currently, we have 3 billionaires who now own more wealth than half of our entire nation's population. And we have 140 million Americans who are either poor or low income. Gomer, has the project of trying to reform capitalism and make it more equitable been a failure? And secondly, can a system like capitalism that is based on the exploitation of the poor and working class to enrich the ruling class, can a system like that even be reformed?
Such great questions. Okay, yes. No. Absolutely not. It can't be reformed. And I'm going to explain why in extremely simple terms, right? We were talking a minute ago about, I'm sorry. I tend to go off on long tangents.
This is your, I'm asking the questions. This is your moment. I talk too much. So and I was on 3 shows this week, at the People Show. So this is your moment today.
All right. Awesome. So what I was talking before about how the companies can't innovate all the time. Technological innovation is only enough to push quarterly profits, maybe 1 or 2 quarters in a row. And then after that, they have to get back to squeezing. If you look at Amazon, for example, right? They didn't get super rich simply by their revolutionary logistics system. That's part of it. But the other part of it is the whole thing of like making workers pee in bottles and having a sweatshop type atmosphere and having super long shifts and people having to come in even when they have COVID. That's how Amazon gets its profits, right? The continual hard squeezing of its laborers. So fundamentally, what we have to look at it is if I went up to your house, right, and I stole that nice painting, and then I stole that plant, and then I stole, you know, your jacket, right? If every day I'm stealing just a little bit more from you, eventually you are going to punch me. So the thing is, when we look at individuals taken from us, taking the things that we need to survive from us, right, then of course we think about it in terms of like, I will stop them. I will do whatever I need to stop somebody from stealing from me. But when we think about it in terms of a boss, suddenly it's impossible to do anything about, right? It's just, oh, that's the way that it is. And the reason that we're taught to feel that kind of hopelessness, to be honest, the reason we're taught to feel like we cannot do anything is because of the police, right? You can't go up and punch your boss because the police will take you away, right? If your boss threatens to fire you unless you take a pay cut, there is no legal recourse for you, right? That's just the way things are. But you know, and I know, that that is evil and wrong, especially in an environment where people are not making enough to survive, right? When your boss is literally saying you have to take a pay cut that will push you below the poverty line, and you just have to do it, right? It's plain evil. So the thing is, getting back to the profits, right? The reason the boss has to do that is because other companies will always be doing that same thing. So there's this race to the bottom of who can squeeze their people the hardest, right? So if one company doesn't squeeze its people very hard, eventually it will be put out of business. It will either be pushed to the sidelines and kept extremely small. So you will see a couple of mom and pop companies who do this kind of thing. But most of the time, they will simply be put out of business for trying to be good, trying to do the right thing. You cannot be a capitalist and survive being a good person. So we have this contradiction, is what it's called, this contradiction between the owning class, the rich people, and then us, the working people. So the state stands in between us. It makes it to where we can't go and attack these rich people for stealing from us and pushing us into poverty, right? And the thing that stands between us and them is the police and the military and the National Guard when things get bad enough. I mean, we could see that from last summer whenever people started protesting the white supremacy aspect of capitalism, the National Guard got deployed, right? So the military and the police are what protect capital. They always have, they always will. So because these businesses have to meet these quarterly targets, they have to make more and more profit every year, they have to squeeze us more and more. It is what's called it's a contradiction that cannot be resolved, right? It's an unresolvable contradiction.
That's built into the system. It's baked into the entire capitalist system.
Exactly. You can't fix it, right? So you can't, the government can step in the way sometimes whenever things get too bad, whenever they start squeezing to the point that people can't have children or people can't survive, then yeah, the government is supposed to step in. But the thing is, in the long term, they'll step in and then they'll step back. They step in, they step back. And every time they step in, they kind of reset the clock and things get a little bit better. But then when they, but then with time, the squeezing and squeezing and squeezing happens. So eventually you get it all back again. And one important thing to mention here is because the way that jobs are organized in this country is fundamentally racist, right? The that certain races and like as in we can just speak openly, non-white people and women are oftentimes barred from these higher paying jobs. They're barred from this social safety net that that white people and men tend to enjoy. We can say that white supremacy and misogyny are equally a part of this system, right? So we will never have an end to these other real deep social issues of racism and misogyny until we destroy what is keeping them afloat, which is capitalism. They're all interlinked. So a communist like myself doesn't just look at class. We don't say that we're all being pushed down the same way. We say, look, yeah, I'm a white guy, and I've been pushed down pretty hard. But my non-white comrades are getting pushed even harder. My female comrades are getting pushed even harder than I am. So I know if things are bad for me, imagine how bad it is for them, right?
That's
so
right.
If I care about myself, if I care about human beings as a whole, but if I care about my people, right, then I have to try to take care of those people too, as in like I have to fight to get them their rights. I have to fight to bring down capitalism for them, right? Because otherwise I am going to get squeezed even harder. The worse it gets for anybody who's more marginalized than I am, the worse it is for everybody, right? So yeah, getting back to your point about can this even be reformed? No, like clearly, right? If they have to squeeze us to stay alive, and that is built into the system, baked into the system, right? Then there's no way to get around it. It's either exploit or die for all of these companies. And so we have to come up with a different system, or rather, we have come up with a different system. We simply have to implement it, or else we're always going to have this problem.
Yeah, and do you think it's time for the – so would you say that it's time for the left to stop trying to reform this capitalist system fight for socialism and fight for the working class to own the means of production?
Absolutely. And that's – you know, that's a big thing that I say to people all the time is that we have to be proud. We have to be loud about this. We have to stop being shy. We have to stop trying to quote-unquote reach across the aisle, right? Because – at the end of the day, what we're fighting for cannot be mixed with capitalism, cannot be reformed into being, right? What we're fighting for is something that is completely different, right? That actually puts the workers first, puts the workers above the companies. And so yeah, absolutely. We, for, 100 years in America, we have been trying to reform our way into saving ourselves, and it hasn't worked. And in fact, you know, things have gotten worse by many metrics. You know, when you, it's very funny. I think that that White Fragility book that came out a little while ago,
yeah.
it went into it a little bit, but it was shocking to a lot of liberals to hear black people say for the first time they've ever actually listened, right? Because I'm sure black people have told them, but for liberals, white liberals to say, oh, I didn't know that things have actually gotten worse for black people in this country, right? It's a terrible thing. That is, I laugh because it's so shocking that so many people are just coming to realize this for the first time now, right? But yeah, by all metrics, things are getting worse. So we had this huge civil rights movement that was a beautiful thing. People putting their lives on the line. People actually dying for their fellow man against a truly racist, evil system. And even still, even after that, they've rolled back all these things. They've made it to where all the things that people fought for is actually harder to achieve. And so yeah, it's worse nowadays than it's ever been. So if things keep going like this, if we continue on without fighting for socialism, as you say, then we're just going to get more of the same. We will never be able to vote our way to freedom.
Yeah, and one thing that's very interesting to me is, you know, that the younger generation now actually has a more favorable view of socialism than capitalism, people that are under 40. But there is still a great deal of fear around socialism and communism in America. But what strikes me most about the fear of socialism in America is it is not rooted in our direct reality. We have never had a socialist or a communist president or government, right? In fact, every single one of our 46 presidents have been right-wing capitalists and imperialists, including our current president, Joe Biden, which yes. means that every single ill in our society comes from capitalism, not socialism. We've never yes. had socialism in America. So the people shouldn't be afraid of socialism or communism. They should be afraid that our decrepit capitalist system has resulted in just 3 billionaires now holding more wealth than half of our entire nation's population, while millions of Americans cannot afford food, housing, and healthcare. They should be afraid of capitalism because it's destroying us and our planet. So, Gomer, where does the fear of socialism and communism come from? And how do we break through it? Because it's so irrational to me that here we have this decrepit capitalist system eating and destroying everything in its path. We have no socialist system in America, you know, and yet people are afraid of socialism. Like, what's going on here, Gomer?
It's kind of hilarious when you think about it, right? So I'll tell you a funny little story. I had known I was a socialist for a long time, right? I had known something was up. I didn't exactly know what was going on, but I knew that our current system could not work. It could not continue, right? So I was looking around and I bought a copy of State and Revolution. And I think we'll even talk about State and Revolution a bit later, but I'm just telling you about the first time I bought a copy of this book, right? And I bought it and I held it in my hands and I had this irrational fear come up. It was like it was this feeling of like looking at Lenin's name, and I was like, this is evil, and like this is wrong. And I realized, I was like, holy hell, this is from my indoctrination as a child. There is no reason to fear a book. There's no like a book can't hurt me. The ideas inside a book can't hurt me. You know what I mean? But this feeling of like this is bad, this is wrong, this is the killer of millions of people, right? You know, blah blah blah. The gut reaction that I felt. It was indoctrination. And I think that so many people, when they speak about socialism nowadays, they repeat talking points that they heard as children by rote, right? When you're arguing with somebody about socialism, they will say things that don't even really apply a lot of times, right? They will say things that are kind of out of left field. And you think to yourself, where did that come from? And the answer is, you're not talking to them on their regular rational level that you might have been 5 minutes ago when you were talking about how bad things are in the workplace. The moment you mention that word, for a lot of people, they just click into their childhood again. So I would just say that we all have this indoctrination that we have to get over that is actually quite difficult to get over and a brave thing to do. So that's why, you know, when I have a friend who is kind of slowly but surely getting interested, reading about socialism, doing more volunteer work in with socialist organizations, perhaps, right? I encourage that so much, right? Because I don't ever want to come up to somebody and be like, okay, you don't get it 100% yet. Well, you better get it 100% now, or else you're part of the problem, right? What I do is I try to tell people like, I foster that, you know what I mean? I support people in their journeys because it's hard. It is hard to unlearn this stuff, you know what I mean? So
yeah, talking, well, Well, and we don't also, like, I feel like what you just said is such a key point that, like, capitalism, it's like shoved in our faces from the moment we're born. You know, it's like you're basically either a red capitalist or a blue capitalist, you know? And like, I just sometimes step back and I'm like, in this beautiful world that humanity's been so blessed to have been given and just to be here on this planet with beautiful creatures and plants and other living organisms, to think that in such a vast world that, like, the only system that we could ever have is capitalism. I mean, that is so arrogant. It is mm-hmm. It is so narrow-minded. It's so ridiculous to think that, like, this is the best and only way. And you know, and then to also think that, like, here in America, not only are we indoctrinated into this capitalist system, we're also told that, like, every time you get to go vote, you can only vote for the red party or the blue party. That's it. You only have two choices, you know? And so it's like, and it just so happens that both of those two choices that they say, you know, that they indoctrinate us with, just so happens that both the blue and the red choices are both capitalist parties whose sole function is to protect, preserve, and maintain our capitalist system. So Hell you yeah. really see just how powerful the government has been, how powerful the corporate media has been, and even our education system has been. It truly just getting people to accept the status quo, to be blind, obedient sheep that, you know, just have to go along with a system that is so corrupt and that continues to, you know, take more and more from the poor and the working class, to give, you know, more wealth to a ruling class who really doesn't need any more wealth. Like, no. The people at the top of the system, that's what frustrates me so much. Like, billionaires don't need any more money. Yet, in the pandemic, they made over $1.3 trillion. The billionaires in America added $1.3 trillion to their bank accounts while the people on the front lines, our working class, our frontline workers, our nurses, our grocery store clerks, you know, they're the ones who were dying from the coronavirus and making, in many cases, starvation wages to keep mm-hmm. this nation afloat, while this capitalist system just puts all the profits up top. So anyone who wants to be rational and objective can just look and see that, like, in this moment, with this level of inequality and this injustice, I would argue that socialism and even communism is the moderate position if you compare it to capitalism, which is extreme and just has resulted in the highest levels of wealth inequality in human history.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, Ryan. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. You know, very interestingly, Lenin in State and Revolution talks about how he calls it a bourgeois democracy, right? So right. The kind of democracy that we have, because all socialism, communism, is fundamentally democratic, right? Capitalism doesn't have the Bogart on democracy. In fact, capitalism doesn't have real democracy, as you just said, that you have to choose between a blue or a red capitalist, right? And what he talks about is how it's a perfect shell for capitalism, for this rule by the rich, this dictatorship that we actually live in, because it makes us think that we have freedom, right? All the things that we grow up hearing about, you know, freedom and liberal rights, you know, we grow up hearing the Constitution constantly. We see these pictures of Martin Luther King, right? We have this indoctrination that is a very positive indoctrination, right? We're indoctrinated against communism, of course. They, you know, they show all these pictures of black and white of people starving, which in a lot of cases, I want you to know, the pictures that they pick of people starving are actually from previous times when the countries were under capitalist rule. Very interesting, but that's a side note. Getting back to it, this positive indoctrination, this indoctrination of, like, well, it ain't perfect, but it's the best we've got. You know, like this, I heard that so many times growing up, right? Talking about our capitalist, shell democracy. But the reason why it works so well is that the people who get elected into office are always immediately beholden to the rich, to the owning class, because they're the ones who get them there by funding their campaigns. They pay them a fairly good amount of money, but then afterwards as well, they go back out and they become lobbyists and such, right?
That's right.
So we have this cycle of the companies paying to get them there, the companies hiring them afterwards, and then them maintaining their riches by taken part in the system. Similarly, the only way that that people are able to get jobs in their areas is by passing certain kinds of legislation, right? So if they want to, like, let's say you have a good person, like a person who is not bought out, quote unquote, by capital whatsoever, and they really care about their constituents. Well, even still, they're beholden to the rest of the party and they're beholden to capital to get those jobs for those people in their areas, right? So they have to vote certain ways in order to toe the party line, right? So
yeah. And we saw that in this latest package. We saw the quote-unquote progressives like AOC and even Bernie and the Squad. They did not go to the mat and fight for a $15 minimum wage for the working class and the poor. They cave to the party, which the Democratic Party is a capitalist party. It is a right-wing capitalist party. And you could argue that the Republican Party is a far-right capitalist party. But we essentially have two right-wing parties in America. We do not have anything that resembles a left or a socialist party in America, contrary to what Fox News says and the Republicans say. The Democratic Party is not a socialist party.
And that, I mean, that is one really funny thing. So first I want to say, I forget who it was. It might have been Kwame Ture who said there's America is a fascist state, but in line with all American decadence, it has two fascist parties.
That's right.
Something like that.
Yep.
But y'all forgive me if I misquote Kwame Ture, y'all who are listening to the podcast. But another thing is that these, you know, people like, you know, talking about Bernie and AOC, right? A lot of people come for me whenever I say anything bad about them because, you know, they are, you know, they care about what's going on, whatever, right? But the whole point of our democratic shell around this capitalist system is that it subverts. Anyone who's good, it corrupts. And you cannot vote in enough people to uncorrupt the system, right? Even if everybody, if literally everybody in the country came together and we're like, we're solid, we're doing this together, we're going to vote 100 Bernies into office and we are going to change this system, it wouldn't work. It simply wouldn't work because the all of the people who are not voted in are still a part of the system, right? So all the people who are appointed are a part of the system, and the system is constructed in such a way as it doesn't require good or bad people to keep it running, right? Whoever's in office really doesn't matter at the end of the day. And this is something that Lenin talked about in 1917. He talked about how the people that get elected actually don't have that much control as it is. The system is a kind of self-running machine in many ways that is bent towards capital. It reminds me very much of how the person that you want in a fundamentally racist system a lot of times is a person who calls himself anti-racist. So for example, with Title IX in schools, right? If you have someone who really cares about their position in Title IX, right, who really wants to fight for the people who've been hurt by others in the position, then that's actually great for the school because they can always hold up this person and say, look at how much this person cares. Look how much they're trying to fight for you. And then in the background, they can be subverting them at every opportunity, right? So,
and that's what we've seen out of the Democratic Party. That's exactly what we've seen. When they're campaigning, when the Democrats are campaigning, they market themselves as if they're the party of the working class. Mm-hmm. Then we give them power and they go in and stab the working class in the back. And we've seen this over and over and over again. And that was one of the reasons I finally woke up. I mean, I was a Democrat for 18 years. I was a loyal, blindly obedient Democrat that always voted party line. And, you know, I supported Bernie in 2016 in the primary, but I went right back to sleep after he lost and the DNC rigged it against him. I voted for Hillary in the general. But it was this time, it was like, it finally, my big awakening was like, oh, it's all just platitudes. Like the Democratic Party sedates us with all these platitudes of hope and change, and then turns around and governs for Wall Street, giant corporations, and the ruling class, and maintains this capitalist system. They have better marketing than the Republicans, you know, whereas the Republicans, they're just like, yeah, we're corrupt, we give tax breaks to billionaires, we're going into more wars, you know. Democrats support all that stuff too. They just kind of co-opt the language of the socialist movement and the progressive movement without actually supporting the policies that would improve the material conditions of the people's lives. And I think it's really funny you bring up, when we talk about electoral politics, I wrote this down. There's a quote from Karl Marx on it, you know, the godfather really of communist theory. And he said, the oppressed are allowed once every few years to decide which particular representatives of the oppressing class are to represent and repress them. And, you know, we have elections in the United States, yes, but the people aren't winning the elections. Big business and the American oligarchs are winning the elections because they own both capitalist parties. So how should the working class view electoral politics in your opinion? You know, can electoral politics be used as a tool to expose to a broader audience the need for a revolutionary socialist movement, you know, to liberate the people and planet from capitalist rule? Like if we, you know, I had Shama Savant on the show last week, and is a Marxist revolutionary socialist. And she's a city council member in Seattle. And she uses her platform to talk about class consciousness. She talks about how, you know, politicians like AOC, they should be going to the mat for the working class, just like, you know, the Joe Manchins of the world and Joe Bidens of the world go to the mat for the class they represent, which is, you know, big business and the wealthy. You know, can we use it as a tool to at least bring more people into the idea of wanting a socialist revolution that we eventually will need to effect the changes we need? You know, how do you view electoral politics?
That's a great question. First of all, I did enjoy watching that podcast last week. Her passion is just fantastic.
But she's amazing.
I would say that there's an important word here. The word is opportunism, right? And many of us have heard the word opportunist used to describe a lot of different things. But when Marxists talk about opportunists, what they're talking about is people who take revolutionary energy and reroute it into stuff that does not work. Right? They take all of the vocabulary, all of the passion of the revolutionaries, and they take the teeth out, right? They say, hey, we want the same, hey, communists, hey, socialists, we want the same thing as you, but we just want to do it a little bit different. We have pragmatism in our socialism. We have a new way of doing socialism. Check this out, right? Every year it's the same shit. And they've been doing this same shit for, 100 years. Like, it's funny when I talk about this, what I'm talking about is things that Lenin talked about in 1912 at this point, right? So opportunism is a perennial problem. And what I will say is that the Democratic Party is fundamentally opportunist, and you cannot get away from it. You cannot vote more progressives into the Democratic Party hoping that it will be less opportunist, because what you are actually doing is feeding the opportunism, right? For every AOC that we elect into the Democratic Party that makes people think, hey, maybe there is a chance, hey, maybe things are changing, right? It robs the people of that revolutionary energy. When people look at the problems of the world and they say, this has got to change, when they are ready to quit their job and join a revolution, right? But somebody comes by and says, hey, you don't have to do that. You don't have to do that. You don't have to do anything too wild. You just have to vote for this person. They're going to fight for you, right? Every time that happens, we feel more and more like we can do nothing and that we have to trust the government to do it for us. Now, the fundamental question you asked is electoralism useful whatsoever, right? Is electoralism good for bringing people into the fold, for expanding socialist education, for getting people riled up and united? What I would say, and I think a lot of people might agree with me who are communists, is that no. The reason is electoralism can be used as such, but only if it is concretely pointed towards building up a revolutionary party, right?
Right.
If you have people who are actually dedicated to a communist revolution and they're running and they say, I'm a communist and we are running in order to show how rigged against anybody but the Democrats and Republicans this is, right? We are only running to show how bad this is, and we're running to get on stage and speak truth to power, and we are communists. We are not going to be moving towards the middle. We're not going to be compromising on our positions, because we understand there is no compromise. There is no mixing of the oil and water that is socialism and capitalism, right? If you had people like that, if you had a party like that, yeah, sure,
Yeah. And see that, and I would say what's interesting is my kind of a pivot, you know, when you start to radicalize, you know, it doesn't, yes, my radicalization at the end of last year was pretty quick, but you have more and more epiphanies along. You know, there's like these moments where you open, your eyes kind of open a little wider. And one recently is kind of what you just said, is you can, you know, if the left, we cannot keep spending so much time and energy and resources into running socialists, in socialist movements and socialist candidates into a capitalist party that just ends up co-opting and destroying them, right? You know, look at Bernie Sanders, for instance, how much time and energy people put into both of those campaigns. And where did that energy go? Yeah. All that energy ended up getting sucked up by the Democratic Party. You know, Bernie had, you know, Bernie woke a lot of people up. Bernie's one of the people who woke me up. And so that part of it is good. But, and I don't know if Bernie intended this. I don't, you know, some people say, well, he's a sheepdog. I think, you know, he wanted to win. But what we saw happen is the DNC rigged it against him both times. And I think a capitalist party like the Democratic Party is always going to use every lever it has to rig the primary process against the most progressive or the most socialist candidate, because their main interest is to protect their corporate donors and to protect big business and to protect the capitalist class. And so I just think I am 100% agreement with you that why spend energy to keep, you know, why keep spending all this energy to funnel, you know, socialists into a capitalist party that just co-opts them and waters it down and gets us further away from the revolutionary change we need to liberate the poor and the working class and communities of color.
That's right.
But when I hear someone like Shama last week, like, she doesn't run in the Democratic Party. She's an independently elected socialist. And the party, Socialist Alternative, they are, you know, they're a Marxist party. They are a revolutionary party. And they do believe in a socialist revolution. Their idea to get there is kind of like what you said. You need a vanguard party. You need to get more and more people awake to socialist leanings and thought and class analysis. But not to funnel that into the Democratic Party, which is just going to destroy it.
So I will say one thing that I think that a vanguard party as such on a national level is too easy to corrupt right now. It's too easy for opportunists to slip in and rise in the ranks, because at the end of the day, the goal of the opportunist is to rise in the ranks. The goal of someone like you or me, when we join a new party, right? We want to do things for the people. We want to try to do things to actually help affect change that works. The opportunist wants the opposite. Yeah, I mean, because I'm talking now about people who know they're opportunists, right? And they do exist, right? I agree with you that Bernie, is he a sheepdog opportunist, or is he just someone who cares that gets used? You know, a lot of people are going to debate about that. But we can all say that there are people – we know there are people who are very cynical about it, right? So the cynical folks are going to get to the top of the party, and a lot of times they're not even going to be put forward as the candidate. This is something I truly believe happened in the Bernie campaign, because I was a volunteer for the Bernie campaign. I'm a fucking communist, and I understand that the Bernie campaign was not a communist campaign, and I understand that it was, you know, in many ways, if it had won, there were problems that, like, you know, the Green New Deal has a lot of imperialist issues with it, right? But anyway, but I care about people. I want people to get health care, you know? So, like, yeah, I'll work against my own interest occasionally just because I give a shit, and it hurts so bad to see my fucking aunt dying because she can't afford medicine. You know what I mean? I've had two family members die just because they couldn't afford medicine. So for me, it pushes me to do things that are sometimes foolish, like work on the Bernie Sanders campaign. But, you know, at the end of the day, when I interacted with the higher ups in the Bernie Sanders campaign, specifically on the volunteer app, whenever Bernie backed down and they started pivoting towards supporting Biden, I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Biden is the opposite of Bernie. Biden is everything that Bernie stands against. Why are we now supporting him? And I got kicked like that. I got kicked like that from the Bernie campaign structure. And the reason is those opportunists get to the top. So if we start a new party, if we start a green party, if we start a people's party or whatever, right? These opportunists are going to get to the top leadership of that party. They're going to be the managers. They're going to be the people who are controlling the day-to-day operations, and they are going to be funneling revolutionary energy into shit that does not work constantly.
What would you say about, like, the Party of Socialism and Liberation, which is a revolutionary party? What do you think about that? You know, is that
Okay,
Educate me, because I don't know. And what are your thoughts on Socialist Alternative as well, which is a Marxist party that, you know, they got Amazon to pay a tax. You know, they pick and choose their battles. And also, I think what you hit on a good point is, well, you know, the whole idea between revolution and reform, I'm in the revolution camp, but until there's enough energy to truly transform society from capitalism to socialism, I'm not naive to the fact that some strong social reforms, if we can never get these corrupt, greedy capitalist parties to support them, you know, when I say strong socialist reforms, I'm not talking about a public option. I'm talking about like Medicare for all. You know, I'm talking about reparations for black people to improve their material conditions. I'm talking about defunding the police, defunding wars, you know, free college, you know, canceling student loan debt. Those are strong social programs, which I would call social democracy. It's not socialism. It's not, you know, putting the means of production into the people's hands and where they belong and putting resources into the people's hands. But until we get to that point, wouldn't, you know, fighting for some social reforms give, it's like a band-aid to capitalism, right? It will give people some relief. And unfortunately, because of our system, it's the people on the margins, it's the poor, it's communities of color, it's the working class who has to bear the brunt of capitalism. So it's like we're fighting this battle of like, yeah, but if you put on too strong of reforms, then it just continues this inevitable thing where we're going to have to keep doing this and keep this same fight against this system that in essence isn't reformable, but we want the people who are struggling under its repressive grip to also get some relief. Do you kind of see what I'm saying? So how do we manage that? Like between, you know, wanting the revolution so we can have a truly equitable economy that is socialism, but also fighting for some reforms until we can get there.
So you have two great questions there. So first you asked me about these alternative parties like Socialist Alternative and PSL, and then talking about should we be fighting for these reforms even if we're not fighting for the Democratic Party. So, I mean, great questions. First one is I'm not a member of a party like PSL or Socialist Alternative for my own reasons. I mean, personally, I think that there are a lot of parties that call themselves revolutionary, but they are not engaged in revolutionary action, which, you know, of course, if you're engaged in revolutionary action nowadays in the United States, you get shut down real quick. I mean, Black Panthers were just doing, you know, feeding programs. Like they were doing education and after school care for kids and feeding kids. And they still got attacked by COINTELPRO, right? They were attacked at every corner. So having a truly revolutionary program is dangerous and capital will come after you. But nonetheless, I struggle with the cadre parties that are out there, which is why I have recently started a new organization to support people starting their own cadres nearby, wherever they live, local, rural cadres, right? So a lot of these bigger parties, they support big actions in cities, but they have trouble reaching out to people in rural areas. Like they certainly have people who are working by themselves and trying to do things, but the structure is not such that they really give a lot of support to these folks. So what I want to do is try to legitimize people working on their own in small groups as communists in the countryside, right? Because all communists have talked about how, like all big communist thinkers have talked about how oftentimes it's the poor, it's the people outside of the liberal mainstream and big cities who are the ones who actually drive the revolution, right? It's the poor criminal class or the disabled inside of cities a lot of times, and it's the peasants outside of cities. So we need to be focusing on them personally, I think. So I think it's okay to not be supporting a revolutionary party right now if you don't feel like they're doing what they need to be doing. But you should still be engaging in communist work in your area. You should still be doing praxis and educating people. Now, to your second question, which I think is very interesting, should we whatsoever be working towards reforms? Well, I meant when I said it that it was kind of foolish for me to be supporting Bernie Sanders because, you know, I mean, I dumped a few thousand dollars into that campaign. I volunteered, you know, a couple hundred hours, and I did it because I care, because at the end of the day, communists just care, right? We'll do things that we know are not smart as far as like we know that it's funneling energy back into a corrupt system. We know that it at the end of the day is not actually helping. But we just care so much about people that we have a hard time saying no to it, right? So, you'll find a lot of communists who very like clear-eyed understood that the Bernie Sanders campaign was A, probably not going to win whatsoever, and B, even if Sanders did get elected, that he was going to be hamstrung at every corner. And of course, it turned out that we were right as far as the flagrant election fraud going on. You know, the Democratic Party getting a judge to even say outright that they didn't have to have free and clear elections because they're a private entity, right?
Yep.
All these like open secrets type things, which is like, you know, people have a hard time admitting and accepting that the primaries are complete, like not just partially rigged, not just a little rigged, they are completely rigged.
Yes, the DNC admitted in court, one of their lawyers, to give context to what you're saying, they said that we can go in a back cigar-filled room and pick out the candidates if we want to, because we are a private corporation. And that was the moment. This was in 2017, actually, the first time they rigged it against Bernie. That was the moment the left should have, you know, bucked up and just left the Democratic Party. I mean, when I found that out, I was like, I mean, I left the Democratic Party last year, and that was one of another things I read. I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, it's time to go. Sorry, but go ahead.
So, yeah, I mean, so it's one of those things, right? It's like, yeah, I know on a logical level it is not going to work. Straight up, funneling any energy and any money into the Democratic Party is not going to work, right? We're not going to get the reforms that we want, and any reform that we do get is going to have some kind of poison pill attached to it, right? So, like, let's say we do get Medicare for all one day. Like, if it gets really close to a revolution and the government comes out and says, okay, we'll do Medicare for all, we'll do UBI, whatever, you know, whatever your pet thing is that you want, they still are going to have to support capital in such a way that capital can continue to squeeze us in the times that it's not innovating, right? Every time they don't come up with a new labor multiplier, the only recourse for meeting corporate profits is going to be to squeeze us a little bit harder. So when that happens, things are going to start rolling back, right? Or they're going to come up with new ways of getting money out of us. One of the biggest new ways of getting money out of us is student debt, right? Basically making it to where you have to have a bachelor's degree, and the cost of a bachelor's degree is going up to 10 times what it was whenever, like, adjusted for inflation, mind you, 10 times still what it was when our parents were in school. So yeah, they've come up with a new way to put us into debt bondage so that we have to work for the rest of our lives. It's going to happen like that again and again. It may not be school. It may be something else. Like, maybe mortgage rates will go like through the roof, or car. I think car interest rates are going to go through the roof. That's one of the ones that's like, it sounds strange, but that is one of the ones that they can get everybody on, because everybody has to own a car. It'll just be something, right? It'll always be something to where they can squeeze us somehow for that little bit of extra money, because the corporations and the government are one. They are the same people. You can't uncorrupt a system when it's made up of all the same people constantly.
So. And I probably should have asked this question at the jump, but most Americans have no idea what communism is, kind of because of all the fear they've been indoctrinated with, as we talked about kind of earlier in the show. So what is communism, and what would a communist society look like? And my second question is, what is the difference between communism and socialism? Because I think that's important too.
Absolutely. All right. So communism, as defined by Engels, is the means for liberation for the working class. All right. Now, that sounds very vague, kind of like, okay, what the hell does that even mean, right? Because a lot of people will say communism is a stateless, moneyless society, classless society, right? They'll kind of go into a lot of the aspects of communism. But the truth is, communism is a program. It is starting from one place where we still have to have a state, right? And it is getting to a place where we don't anymore, where the state withers by itself. It is a revolution followed by the working class taking over, followed by the elimination of the working class because of the elimination of the rich. Once the rich don't exist, the working class don't exist either. We're all just people. So communism is getting to that point. It's liberation for everybody. It is the destruction of white supremacy. Now, it is the destruction of all kinds of exploitation, right? The exploitation of women, the exploitation of one could even say of, you know, queers like us, right? That that we also are exploited in many ways in this society. So
absolutely.
So what we can say very simply is that communism has a fundamentally anti-capitalist program, a revolutionary anti-capitalist program that in the end will end in a place where there's liberation for all. So if that sounds too uh, too highfalutin, if it sounds a little bit too broad brush, then what we have to think about is that the definitions that capital gives us for things, the definitions that we're taught in school a lot of times, are simply taught so that we can reject them, right? We're taught wrong things so that we can reject the wrong thing, right? And I think that what we're taught about communism in particular is that we're taught about, like, we're taught a very wrong thing about, like, you know, gulags and repression and, you know, pogroms and all kind of stuff, and red fascism, people say all the time, things like that, right? So they kind of have this collection of total falsehoods that they slap together and say that's communism, right? And then you read a little bit more, you read some theory, and people say, oh, it's just a moneyless, stateless society. Put it in a box. And then if you want that, then you can believe that. But if you want other things, then you can believe these other boxes, right? And that's called eclecticism, the kind of picking and choosing of different ideologies that people do in America, where they slap things together and say, this is my ideology. This is what I believe, right?
At the soup and salad buffet. I'll have a little of this. I'll take a little of this. I'll take a little of that. And I want a little bit of that.
Exactly. So what we as communists do is we study what works. We study what's going on in our world, right? We study who's getting money, who's getting oppressed, who has power. And we say, okay, whatever's going on, we're going to make a program to make sure that the people who have power now, if they are the rich, lose power, and the people who don't have power, the poor, the working class, gain it, right? So communism, the lower stage of communism, as Lenin calls it, which is the socialist stage, when there is still a government, right? That looks different from time to time, right? It looked different in Cuba, it looked different in the early stages of the USSR, it looked different in the early stages of China, right? All of these governments were very different people. They were very different things they were fighting back against. And so the early governments looked very different, right? And then the later governments, of course, looked even more different. So what we can say is, fundamentally, what is Marxism? Marxism is dialectical materialism, point blank. That's all it is. And what that means is really looking at the way things are, really looking at what's changing, what's dominant and what's submissive, right? What is a conflicting in society, and basing your worldview around an understanding of those.
And one of the basic things that, and I think society kind of, I don't know the way to phrase this, but one of my basic just awakenings last year when I realized I was a socialist is, well, yeah, you know, in order to have a ruling class up here, you literally have to have a poor and a working class that the ruling mm-hmm. class exploits, like mm-hmm. right, like there's no other way to do it. And so when you realize that the reason Jeff Bezos has all the money he has, it's not because he worked harder than anyone else. Nobody works harder than poor and working class people. It's mm-hmm. that he exploited their labor, you know. And yep. it's just like, you know, do you want to live in a society where people have to be exploited? And then you see people who make it successful, quote unquote, in America. And what they don't realize is, like, you know, you made it there off the backs of the working class and of the poor who put who shipped your goods to market for you, who spent 50 hours in a factory that week, you know, working for starvation wages, not even getting health care. You know, many of these companies don't even pay for their employees' health care. And so you realize that, like, oh, okay, so the whole reason billionaires exist, you know, they didn't earn that money. They took that money. They stole that money. They exactly. stole that money from the people, from the planet, you know, from hoarding resources. And then
yes,
when you,
yes.
you know, you yes. learn about imperialism, and that's when you really, you know, you start to read Lenin and you see, like, oh, so the United States, you know, it doesn't just exploit the poor and the working class, you know, it also, like, goes in and bombs and invades and starts wars to hoard other, you know, underdeveloped countries and third world countries and take their resources to enrich the oligarchs back at home. And you mm-hmm. just see that the whole system itself is, there is no lesser of two evils. The entire system is evil and the entire system is corrupt. And it leads you down this path of, in my opinion, the reason capitalists are so threatened by socialists and so threatened by communists is that the whole idea of socialism itself actually, like, puts a mirror up to capitalism and is like, look, this is what y'all are really doing. No mm-hmm. amount of marketing, no MSNBC pundit can actually hide the fact that you're exploiting the poor, that you're exploiting children, that you're putting children at the border in cages, right? And not only are you putting them in cages, they're profiting. Those are for-profit detention centers. They're profiting off putting children in cages. You know, yep. You look at the industry like our mass incarceration. They are locking up predominantly black and brown people for nonviolent offenses, for marijuana crimes, although we're finally making progress there. But because the prison system is for profit. So they're actually, not only are we locking up black and brown people unjustly, the system does it to profit off of it, right? Then you look at our healthcare system. They're profiting off of human sickness and suffering, you know? And so you see that, you know, not only is just from the exploitation perspective, you look at some of these industries and they're literally profiting off human suffering, incarceration, sickness. Look at the energy industry. It's literally profiting off of destroying our planet and burning, you know, fossil fuels, which are heating the planet. And so you just see how unjust it is. And I think socialism is a big mirror to that, which is why they fight so hard against it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what's funny is that, like, what we end up talking about at the end of the day, what communists end up talking about is the most simplest things on earth, right? We say, hey, look, the planet's dying. Y'all know. Y'all, the scientists know. We know. It's always these big, large, difficult to understand lies that get in the way, right? When we talk about healthcare, right? We talk about how Sri Lanka can afford to have universal healthcare, but somehow the United States can't, and there'll always be like this big, confusing thing about like, oh, there's reasons, economics, right? And you'll be like, well, no, I mean, if we have the largest economy on earth, if we have more efficiency in our workforce than any other country, we can afford it. So like, just what socialism does is it cuts out the bullshit. It cuts out all the lies. You know what I mean? And you talk about exploiting people overseas, right? Fundamentally, value comes from two places: nature and labor power, right? There are things that can multiply the value of labor power, right? Like your computer, like machinery, right? But fundamentally, we don't get these big advances all the time, right? So, like you said, what these big companies do is they just find better and better ways of either destroying nature or exploiting people. And sometimes the people back home don't want to get exploited anymore. They refuse to be exploited anymore. So they start threatening these companies, right? So what do? They use the military to go and open up new markets overseas, right? When the markets get saturated back home, when people can't afford anything anymore, they go overseas, they disrupt the government, they make everything really wild and destitute over there, and they take the natural resources and they sell them back the finished products. Everywhere you can see where America has quote unquote liberated and brought democracy, what you can find is in fact a manufacturing industry going down. You will see them producing fewer and fewer goods year after year. And that alone should show, right, that what we're doing is we go over there and we kill their industries, we take their resources, we sell them back the finished goods, and we take the surplus value between those two, right, between the finished goods and the natural resources for ourselves and leave them destitute. So Africa is not underdeveloped. It is overexploited.
That's
South
right.
America is not underdeveloped, right? It's purposeful. And the scariest thing to me, the reason why many of us communists have an immediacy to what we want, right? We have a passion and a demand that people that people actually wake up and start working together on this stuff is that we know that more wars are coming. Whenever things happen to where the economy starts going down, whenever we have bad markets, the easiest solution for capitalists is not to fund a bunch of research back home to make new ways of improving our productivity. No. It's to go and open up a new market forcibly overseas, to go and crash some government somewhere so that we can start stealing the natural resources. So that's why, you know, people that I know, you know, my veteran friends a lot of times are scared shitless about us attacking Iran this year,
yep,
like literally this year, and then very likely China in the near future, right? In 10 years from now, China, right? So we're gearing up for these forever wars. Now, one thing I want to say, Ryan, and this is very important to me, right? So much of what we've talked about right now is like sad shit. You know what I mean? Like it is dark. But the good thing about being a communist, right? And sometimes I use the term socialist and communist interchangeably, but when I say socialist, what I mean is someone who wants to have a revolution so that you can have a proletarian government, right? You can have a democracy, but a democracy only for the working class, right? That the rich don't get to control the government like they do anymore, right? So for the communist, we have hope. We see a way forward, right? We don't look at all the failures of the past and say, oh shit, we got to try more of this. Maybe if we just try harder, the same shit that fails again and again, maybe we'll make it happen, right? The progressive has to look at things that have failed and say, let's try it again. The communist doesn't. The communist looks at things that have worked. The communist looks at poor dirt farmers in Russia overthrowing a truly evil czar, right? The communist looks at different places where people who are passionate alone, not that educated, not well-funded, right, have been able to throw the yoke off of their masters, right? So we know that a revolution is possible in this United States, right? We know the character of the American people is independent and strong. And so all we have to do is get through all this propaganda to get at the heart of who the American working person is, right? To get to that core of understanding the value of democracy and the value of their fellow man, right? And understanding that there is a way forward. If we can make people latch onto that, if we can show them that there is something out there besides the two-party system, then we'll be all right. We will be able to fight it.
It's very well said. Do you think because Americans have been so indoctrinated to fear socialism, do you think that one of the approaches I've hearing a lot recently is pushing for public ownership of certain industries, right? So like public ownership of the healthcare industry, which is very easy to argue that it should not be a for-profit industry. Nobody should be, you know, making billions of dollars off suffering and off of people's cancer, right? You know, do you think pushing for that kind of public ownership of, say, healthcare and utility companies to show the American people how socialism is more effective than capitalism, to kind of give people a little taste of it so then they'll want more? What do you think about that approach?
Sure.
And does that get in the way of like the larger revolution that you know, maybe like the revolution, you start the revolution of let's revolutionize healthcare, then we'll revolutionize the energy industry, then we'll revolutionize, right? And then hopefully that kind of would gain steam. People would be like, yeah, well, I want to own a piece of, you know, my own healthcare. I don't want, you know, my healthcare to be in the hands of a for-profit company that is, you know, could deny my claim if I get sick and I can't, you know, afford the deductible.
In the best of all worlds, then yeah, we would be going after that. Like we would, like, honestly, to have public ownership of everything, specifically talking about things like utilities and healthcare and such, right? That is what we know to be anathema to capital, right? Capital, as soon as they orchestrate a coup in a foreign country, the first thing that they do is they deregulate and they sell off all of the public assets of things like utilities and healthcare, right? They sell off all public holdings. So yeah, we know that capital very much is scared by that kind of thing. The problem is in America, we've tried. We have really tried many times to get a public, like just a public option, period. But but we've tried for Medicare for All, right? And it just year after year, it doesn't happen. Year after year. So what we have started looking at now, what Black folk have been looking at since the '60s, with the Black Panther Party. But what we all have started looking at now is the idea of dual power, of setting up alternative institutions outside of the government that is run by us, right? So food programs. I'm engaged in a lot of different food feeding programs, right? And they have sprung up thousands across the United States, feeding the unhoused and feeding regular people, right? We have things where people are trying to build tiny homes, right? We have things where people are trying to do education programs for free in their neighborhood, right? I've seen so many of these like very specific to your neighborhood type organizations. Mutual aid. That's exactly right. Right. So it starts now with these very small, paltry type mutual aid efforts that we're doing, right? Just trying to get through the pandemic, just trying to fight back against landlords with tenants unions without actually asking the government for help because the government ain't helping. Right. So we go and we stand in people's yards and say, no, you are not going to evict these people. Right. So that kind of people power is valuable. I mean, it's strong and it gives people hope, right? So whenever you don't have to beg some elected official to go to bat for you, whenever you go to bat for yourself and your neighborhood, you get dignity that you never had before. You know, you have a feeling of strength and an understanding that things can actually change. That is very new, I think, to so many people. Right. So, I'm engaged in a number of different mutual aid efforts, not because I think they are necessarily more efficient and more effective than what the government can do. Obviously, the government, if they really tried hard, could turn things around and do much better than me buying shit from the 99-cent store and giving it out to my unhoused neighbors. But nonetheless, this dual power building type energy and activity that's going on right now, I believe, is the way of the future. So for me, I don't do electoral politics anymore. I focus entirely on mutual aid. I focus on tenants' unions. I focus on cop watches. I focus on feeding the unhoused and feeding my neighbors. So I'm involved in a couple of different organizations. I have a full-time job, and then I run around kind of ragged afterwards. But I believe in education. So things like you're doing, as far as like podcasts that bring socialists on and have people talk about the truth of things, important, right? What I do, I talk about communist texts on my stream. It's important, right? Because the more that we teach people about the truth, right, the more that they may be able to engage in some of these mutual aid type activities, the more they'll stop feeling helpless, the more they'll feel like they can actually do something. And I'll tell you, the helplessness is the biggest sap of energy of all. Right. That feeling that you can't do anything, that is what stops people from volunteering. It's what stops people from, politics aside, just doing things in their neighborhood. Right. So that whenever people start feeling like they're actually doing something, I'll tell you, the first time someone tells a cop to fuck off, whenever they're doing a tenant defense, right, an eviction defense, and the cop actually leaves, that person is hooked for life. You know what I mean? That person says, I have strength that I never knew I had. You know what I mean?
Well, and it shows the powerful, you know, they think they run us, but no, like we have the power. We run this country. Like this country is made up of working class people who make it run. We are the engine of the country. And I think the pandemic showed that to a lot of people. Like nobody needed these billionaires. You know, we needed the person at the gas station. We needed the person at the grocery store. We needed the nurses. We didn't need, you know, all these extravagant people. And even when you look at things, it made Hollywood just look so frivolous, if you will. You know, all of these celebrities who were just, you know, always, you know, who kind of, and in some ways, I feel like they've kind of become the PR department for capitalism, especially when, you know, there was all these kind of blue check celebrities when I decided I wouldn't endorse Biden because I refused to vote for any evil and I couldn't support either capitalist party. I was like attacked. There was like a group of like 10 of them one day last year. And, you know, all these neoliberal celebrities attacking some little activist on Twitter and they were shaming me and look at him. He's so evil. He's not going to vote for Biden. And, you know, he's refusing to support either, you know, Biden or Trump. And it's like, in many ways, I feel like Hollywood is just like a big distraction. They douse people. And yes, I mean, entertainment and songs and movies and films, if they're really educating, can be good. But in many ways, I feel like Hollywood kind of, you know, it dresses up capitalism in a way. It just like makes it look like our system is so glamorous and that it's working. And then I think it gives poor and working class people, they look at that and they kind of fantasize about it. And maybe it's a nice distraction from the everyday hardships of their life. But the truth is that people shouldn't be exploited, that we should all be liberated, that we should all live in a world where there's justice and dignity for all people, where we don't need an industry that just distracts us and entertains us from and gives us an escape from the cruelties of this world. There shouldn't be these cruelties. And there definitely shouldn't be these cruelties. In the system we have, the reason there's cruelty is because they, like you've said throughout this podcast, they have to squeeze. They have to squeeze the poor. They have to squeeze the working class. They have to squeeze communities of color and marginalized groups to enrich the ruling class. And that to me is just is the reason I am a socialist now and becoming more revolutionary every day. I'm sick of it. I'm just sick of the system that we have.
Absolutely.
And I see no hope in the system we have. What I see hope in is having conversations with people like you who are, like you said, building power outside of it. And this kind of brings me to my last segment here. And you kind of touched on it a bit ago, but there's a new report out from Oxfam that the world's, there's 2,100 billionaires in the world. And they now, the 2,100 billionaires now hold more wealth than 60% of the planet's population, which is roughly 4.6 billion people. The levels of wealth inequality have grown so extreme that I think people have just grown numb to it, and they just submit that this is the way things are, and you know, we can't do anything about it. But that's not true. The people of this world can stop all of this inequality and exploitation at any time if we rise up together in solidarity and say enough. Gomer, you tweeted recently that revolutionary optimism doesn't mean being happy all the time. Yes, I get enraged at the state of the world and depressed with my life sometimes, but I also just know that I'm a part of an unstoppable global struggle for human decency and mutual aid. You know, amidst so much injustice, inequality, and despair, it is easy sometimes to give up and feel like nothing matters. So can you talk about how you find joy and hope in the struggle for liberation, and how that when you look at a stat that like 2,000 billionaires are hoarding more wealth than 4.6 billion people, you realize that, that capitalism is unsustainable and it is going to just keep getting worse and worse. And that really the only hope humanity has left is the people coming together in solidarity and fighting for a global socialist revolution.
That's absolutely, absolutely. I can talk about that. So for me, you know, I worked pretty hard to get where I am, where I work. And I had this epiphany one day that it didn't bring me the joy that I thought it would. This personal achievement didn't do for me what I thought it would, right? And I always had this idea, because they teach us when you're young, like if you get a job you love, you'll never work a day in your life, right? I don't know if you ever.
My dad taught me that. My dad said that. Yeah.
So what I found is it's not true, right? I found that work alone was not what gave me joy. What I found gave me joy was taking part in something bigger than myself. But also, I have to say this: you have to put up wins on the board. You have to see things are actually changing, right? And that's why I can't be dumping energy into the Democratic Party alone, because I tried that before for years. You know, I was trying to do things the quote unquote nonviolent way, the quote unquote proper channels way. You know what I mean? And what I found is it's disheartening. It's depressing, right? But when I started doing something where I realized that it was actually an affront to capitalism, right? When I realized that I could do things that would stop an individual police officer from hurting an individual family, right? When I realized that I could give somebody some food and keep them alive for one more week, right? That's a win. That is a big win, right? Mm. And so these things keep me going. These activities that I have, whenever I talk to somebody about communism and I tell them that it ain't about subjugation of regular people, right? It ain't about hurting folks. It ain't about, you know, all the things that we're taught. It's about decency. It's about caring for your fellow man and making sure that everybody's needs are met, right? Having a government that is actually built around helping people, right? When I tell people that and their eyes light up and they understand that like they've been propagandized their whole lives against something that is actually necessary for their long-term survival, that actually there are things out there that they've never thought about before, and they have this curiosity and this hopefulness, especially about politics, that so many people like get turned off by, right? When I talk to somebody and they suddenly for the first time in their life are like curious about learning about politics and reading some book from 100 years ago, like that's very wild to me, right? So yeah, this revolutionary optimism I have comes in part from these small wins, you know, from all these things where I do something and I see the effect in the world. That's why I believe in dual power and forming your own small cadres where you are. But also looking across the world and seeing that people, we're not just fighting in the United States, right? If we truly are a part of a brotherhood of man, then the folks in the third world who are fighting against capital, the folks in, you know, you talk about Bolivia, you talk about all these revolutions that are happening that we don't really hear too much about in the news, right? Because they hide it from us. But, you know, when we see these things, we understand that they're fighting in their part of the world against the big machines that are fighting against us too, right? These multinational corporations that are actually running the governments of not just our government, but many, many different governments, right? In fact, more directly in many parts of the world, they run the governments, right? when we see that we're fighting for the same thing that they're fighting for, and that the only thing that the capitalists actually are good at building is their own gravestones, right? When we see that they are hurtling towards their own demise, right? That they cannot stop even to let a Bernie Sanders win in order to prolong capitalism. When we see that they're so focused on quarterly profits that they will literally destroy themselves in a few years, right? And they just accept the fact that they're going to try to get theirs and get out before the end actually comes, right? Whenever we see that communism is inevitable simply because of the way things are going in this world where capitalism is destroying itself, right? It gives me hope. It gives me hope that I'm taking part in something that will ultimately win, that will that my efforts are not in vain. And even if the worst happens to me, it won't be in vain. And all the people that came in the past before me who put their lives on the line, who dedicated their entire lives to teaching people and making people's lives better, their lives were not lost in vain. You know what I mean? We're doing something that is a multi-decade, sometimes we could even say multi-century project, but it's as immediately necessary for us to work on now as it ever was in any year in the past, and it will be in the future.
That's so well said. And also, you know, one thing I like is, yes, it's we need a global revolution, but that global revolution starts in your local communities. And you tweeted something that the other day that I thought was so profound. You said, "Communists of Los Angeles, we went out again today to deliver food and supplies to our unhoused neighbors. Added another comrade and another encampment served. Started planning a community food drive we've raised the funds for. These people truly make me glad I live here." And this is my final question to you. Does getting out into the community help fight back against the stigma associated with socialism and communism and show the power and possibility of collective action and collective organizing?
Absolutely. It's necessary. It's not just that it shows it. It's that you're not a communist unless you're actively trying to help people in your area. Now, for the disabled folks who listen to your podcast, that don't mean you have to be on the ground, right? It don't mean that you have to, if you have a immunodeficiency and right now it's not safe for you to be outside, that you have to be out giving out peanut butter jars to your unhoused neighbors. There are ways to help. There are ways to enable people who can be on the ground. We're all interdependent on this thing. You know what I mean? Like, we have the people who donate to us a lot of times are people who can't leave their house, right? So someone who is as poor as you or me, someone who works a regular old job, like we have people who donate to us who work jobs at like Walmart, McDonald's, you know what I mean? And $5 from them, I know actually hurts their pocketbook to give up that little bit, that $5, that little bit of money, right? So we don't try to be like a televangelist begging for every bit, right? We put in, it's funny talking about, people coming for you on Twitter and how much you make on your podcast and how both of us have given thousands of dollars more away than we ever make on,
yes.
on our podcast.
I always laugh. I'm like, my podcast makes a few $100 a month and, the work that goes into it and just it's crazy. I mean, but that's what people do. When you fight back against capital, when you fight back against the corrupt system, they're going to try to demonize and this is what they do. This is what they've done to any socialists throughout history. I mean, the FBI had an entire program, like you said, that fought against socialists and infiltrated their organizations. And just look what happened to, the greatest, anti-capitalists and socialists in our country's history, people like MLK, people like Fred Hampton and Malcolm X, they were assassinated for fighting to liberate the people from capitalist rule. Absolutely. It is. But at the end of the day, I just think that people can feel it, in your gut when you just feel something's not right. And I also think people's bank accounts aren't lying to them. Again, the poor and the working class just keep getting poorer and poorer the last four decades, and the rich just keep getting richer. And we're just, we're reaching a point where it's not sustainable. And so it's going to take, people who are bold and brave enough to, talk about revolutionary solutions and talk about socialism and undo all the propaganda. I mean, for me, really, becoming a socialist, it wasn't about learning as much as it was about unlearning. I had to unlearn all of the propaganda I had been raised on. And then once you unlearn that, then you can, yes, you can absorb and you can learn new information. But the fear that is in America and that just keeps people so obedient to a system that is actually working and rigged against them, that's rigged against everyone who's in the 99%, It is amazing the levels that the 1% and the capitalists will go to demonize anyone who is empowering people or educating people or getting people to think outside the box. And so I've been called a grifter every day since I left the Democratic Party. When it's like, if you go look back in 2018, I worked for a Democratic PAC, and I think I made $3,000 a month when I worked for the Democratic Party. Well, after I left the Democratic Party, you can look, my podcast makes like $500 a month. So yeah, I'm really in it for the money when I knew I would be leaving and making less money. I mean, some people just are passionate and want to fight for something different. And I think people don't recognize that. I think they anyone who's like fighting for their values in a society where people have to sell out their values every day, I think that people think it's weird that like someone has conviction and someone's not backing down and someone's, you know, fighting back against the corruption. I think that some people, it's hard for people to resonate with because this society forces us to sell out in many ways just to stay alive. We have to sell out.
It does. But that's, I think it's such an important thing to mention because we have that push from these people who call us grifters or whatever, who always will be having negative things to say. But I think we're working on them too. You know what I mean? To see somebody doing both praxis and education, to see somebody growing in a way that they don't feel like is possible, it gives them, it puts an itch in their brain, you know, and I think they'll come around. But, you know, to get back to your previous question, because I do want to say it before I go. We do get out there and do both the what we call praxis, as in like bringing about socialism in the world, doing good things for people, right? That's praxis, as well as theory, right? We have a reading group where we read communist texts afterwards as well, so we do both together. And the reason we do that is people have to see, like, if you are talking about other people seeing communists and being less scared of communists, they have to see us doing work in the world. But we also have to work on ourselves. So we're teaching and learning ourselves as we teach and learn the masses, right? We learn, we have to have a give and take for all of it, right? We have to see ourselves as students, not just leaders, right? And I think that's very important, is that communists have to have this humility. We have to have this this way about us that shows that we are regular people, that we care about normal things like, you know, our aunts and uncles dying because they don't get medicine, and we want to help you in concrete ways, like giving you food, like bringing you medicine if you need it, right? Whatever you need, whatever the community is needing, that's what the communists are going to work on, right? And we are also willing to talk to you about what we believe. We're not sitting in some ivory tower giving you charity. We're coming to you as a member of the community who is just like you, who is not above you, who is not different from you, who just has some things that we've learned about that we want to share with you. You know what I mean? So communists have to be like that. We have to be from that point of view of like, you know, actually feeling like we are a member of the community, because people can sniff it out. If you feel like you're above, if you feel all highfalutin, you feel egotistical, people sniff it out. So it is important.
What are three books you recommend people read for, you know, socialist and communist theory? If you could just think of three books right now, people that are listening, what are three books you'd recommend?
All right. Hear me out. Principles of Communism by Engels is a very good introductory text. If you hate reading, if you are not a book person, quote unquote, that book is very simple. It lays everything out in a very clear, concise way. It's only a few pages. I've read it. I'm sorry. My country ass. I've read it multiple times in a week before, right? Then I do believe that State and Revolution by Lenin is a necessary text, right?
I just read it a few months ago. It's an easy read, and it's a very eye-opening read.
Absolutely, because it's the one that shows me that like there's no way to do it except through revolution, and that the people who try to sell me something different are trying to sell me something. Finally, I would say read either the Huey P. Newton Reader or Blood in My Eye by George Jackson. Blood in My Eye by George Jackson has affected me more than any other book that I've ever read. It is a very revolutionary book, but studying the Black Panthers in particular, looking at Angela Davis's Women, Race, and Class, looking at the autobiography of Assata Shakur, right? All of these books show praxis and education together in a way that just doesn't get taught to us very often, right? So I highly recommend Blood in My Eye. I love that book, but If you are more focused, if you care more about the plight of women, Angela Davis's Women Racing Class. If you want to get a more general overview of what life was like with the Black Panthers, then the Huey P. Newton Reader. Read one of those. I'm sorry I didn't give you a third single book, but
Great. And finally, man, I could talk to you all day. I'm just looking at the clock. I'm like, we went way over time. I hope people got as much out of this podcast as I have, because you've really opened my eyes wider, and I love listening to you. How can people follow you? I know you twit. You have these Twitch streams where you go and you try to educate people about communism. How can they follow your Twitch channel?
So on Twitch, I am Comrade Gomer, twitch.tv/ComradeGomer. If you want to see some of my old streams, and a lot of people do like to listen to my old streams, like podcasts in the background, then you can go to youtube.com/c/ComradeGomer. We have just started a new group for supporting local cadres, like local small communist groups. You can go to thecommunistorg.com, and we'll try to support you any way we can if you're trying to start a local communist group. Also on Twitter, I am @allcommie, @allcommie. I used to be full commie, but we could talk another time about how Twitter takes down communist pages.
They do. That's right. You just got your account taken away from you a few months ago, and you didn't do anything to violate the terms of service, right? They're starting to silence and censor the left. Yep. Here we go.
They even told, I mean, watch out, Ryan. You might lose your account one day. I don't want to put no bad stuff on you, but yeah, they even told me. They were like, yeah, we're not shutting it down for any reason. You just can't get in anymore.
This is why censorship is bad, people.
But yeah, well, that's okay, because I just want to say that kind of thing shows me that I'm doing something right. You know what I mean? When capital starts coming after you individually, you know you're doing something right. So if you want to hear more about this, if I spoke about things in a kind of clear, straightforward way that might have resonated with you, I love interacting with people on a regular basis. So talk to me on Twitter, come to my Twitch streams. It's very casual, you know what I mean? Because all I want to do is tell people about communism in a way they'll understand and meet people where they're at.
Gomer, thank you very much for coming on the show today, and thank you for doing what you're doing, and let's keep in touch, and we'll talk soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Ron. I appreciate
it. All right, brother. Solidarity.
Solidarity, comrade. See ya.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight. And before I go, I want to take this moment to thank our benefactors who make this show possible, who contribute at least $20 a month to the program. I want to thank Tyler Sambucci, Nat Tacito, Ed Romo, John Littman, Tiffany Mahmood, John Paul DeLuca, Susan Sarandon, DJ Comatose, Patty Cleary, Elizabeth Kim, and Lloyd Chapman. Thank you so much for your generous donations, and thank you everyone for supporting the podcast and supporting my work. I really appreciate it. Again, go to patreon.com/ampedup if you want to support the podcast as well. And for as little as $5 a month, you'll get access to our bonus content. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we'll catch you next week with an all-new episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight.